Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Gates, a tradition of innovation. We are on season three this morning, episode six, and I am here with Ian Knight. He is entomologist. Is that how you say that?
Entomologist.
That's who you are. And you're with the Aquatic Ecology and Invasive Species branch with the Environmental Laboratory. And we're going to be talking about the good, the bad, and the bugly.
I love that name.
the bugs and invasive plants. So, good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm doing all right.
You know, I worked hard on that title.
It was a good one.
It might go down as probably the best one we've come up with so far. So anyway, so tell me about yourself and your background, Ian.
Yeah, so like you said, I'm an entomologist. I have a master's of science and a PhD in entomology from the University of Georgia. I got that in 2017, so not super long ago. After that, I did a postdoc at LSU working on the invasive rosocane scale in Phragmites down to the Mississippi River Delta. And then before I became a full-time fed, I was a postdoc here at ERDC, an ORISE postdoc, where I worked on the cold tolerance of some of our biological control agents.
Okay. So that just dives into, what is your role at ERDC?
Yeah, so now I'm a research biologist in the Aquatic Ecology and Invasive Species branch. I'm part of the biomanagement team. So within that branch, there's a couple of teams. I'm on the biomanagement team, and we focus primarily on invasive aquatic weeds. And then even within the biomanagement team, there's kind of like two subdivisions. There's like the herbicide guys and the biocontrol guys. And I'm on the biocontrol side. And so what we do is we help stakeholders manage invasive aquatic weeds through biological control.
Okay. So you get into the weeds of it, right?
Yeah.
So can you tell us about some of the invasive plant species that pose a threat to our ecosystems in this area? And what makes that such a problem?
Yeah. So... Well, the ones that come to mind immediately are some of the invasive aquatics, because those are the ones that we primarily deal with in the aquatic ecology branch.
Okay, right, exactly.
And so some of the ones that I spend a lot of time with, the first one that comes to mind is alligator weed. We also work with giant salvinia, water hyacinth, parrot's feather, hydrilla, some others that, you know, we don't really have here in Mississippi, but flowering rush, nymphoides, yellow floating heart. So there's a bunch that all do very similar things.
So what do these plants do?
So one of the biggest issues is they tend to outcompete and displace other native aquatic species. That can be anywhere from like just crowding out other plants, where they'll just completely dominate a habitat, and all those like native species that should be there get pushed out. And then all the other species that rely on them for like food or habitat, they tend to get displaced as well. Floating plants like salvinia can also smother plants like SAVs or submerged aquatic vegetation. So all those plants that kind of grow under the surface, floating plants can smother those. And then a lot of times what will happen is the high biomass production. These plants can put out so much material that when they eventually die, all that material sinks and decomposes, and it can really deplete oxygen levels. So,
really?
Yeah.
Wow. So, go ahead.
So, that's just the ecological side.
Right.
Sorry.
No, I dive into it.
There's a whole
Absolutely.
Other reason why the core cares. and that's because, in addition to just being bad for all the native species that live in these systems, these weeds can like have really bad, big management implications too. They can impede recreation. So, any place that the core manages, for recreation, these plants can get in the way, either just physically getting in the way. Some of them can be really unpleasant to swim around.
When you say unpleasant, what do you mean?
Well, one that comes to mind, and we don't actually have it here in the States yet, but it's a plant called water soldier, which is at risk of working its way into the Great Lakes up from Canada. And in addition to doing all the things I just described, the leaves are really sharp and kind of serrated. Ooh. And working with them is super unpleasant. And if you swim into them, you'll get cut up real bad.
Ooh.
Most of our plants don't do that. Most of the time, they're just, they'll get in the way of, like I said, recreation. They can clog up waterways so you can't get your boats through. So they impede navigation. Sometimes infestations can get so thick in like navigable waterways that it impedes like navigation equipment. They can clog or interfere with locks and dams. And so, yeah, lots of core operations can be impeded by really severe infestations of aquatic weeds.
So the way that they travel from one body of water to another is what, boats that they, the I guess the seeds or something get on the boats and then you take a boat somewhere else? I mean, how does it travel to another body of water like that?
Well, so assuming that you were not just talking about them moving,
right,
you know, within connected waterways, yeah, that tends to be the big one.
Okay.
Is making sure that, you know, people wash their boats because, you know,
so
these materials, a lot of these can grow clonally too. Mm-hmm. So it's not even seeds. It's literally just plant material that clings to a boat. It's pulled out of one water body and put into another. And yeah, that's how they spread. In fact, okay, when we're out looking for sites to study invasive species, or we're trying to collect genetic material for some of our studies, the best place to look for infestations of floating aquatic weeds is around boat ramps, because that's where they're getting in.
Gotcha. 10-4. Okay. So I understand you're using an interesting approach to controlling invasive plants. How are bugs involved?
Yeah. Well, so we kind of hinted at it. It's biological control or biocontrol. And it's not exclusively insects. Now, I'm an entomologist, and that's primarily what I work with, but it's not just insects. It's essentially using what we call natural enemies, and it's any kind of organism that, you know, preys or impedes, you know, our target organism, because mm-hmm. biocontrol isn't just for plants either. You can control lots of invasive species. But yeah, and so the idea is that we use these natural enemies, so insects, pathogens, mites, little like other arthropods that will feed on these plants, mm-hmm. To essentially reduce these infestations. And that can happen a lot of different ways. So some of the ones that, you know, I've been working with a lot recently are defoliators. So these are the kind of the most obvious ones. These guys just will munch on the leaves and then chow down on them just like a cow might. Like cows or goats. They're like little tiny, very species-specific goats.
Okay.
Or leaf miners, which do something similar, but they don't necessarily completely defoliate a plant. They'll just, you know, destroy leaf tissue or provide openings for other pathogens to get in. There's seed and flower feeders. So these are insects that will kind of get into developing seeds or flowers. And they won't so much kill a plant so much as they will reduce its ability to reproduce. So
really?
These tend to be more effective for, like, you know, annual species where you can get in. If you can reduce that seed bank over time,
okay,
that's one of the ways you can use biocontrol to control them. Meristem feeders, that's a little bit like the defoliators, but how they act is a little different because they, again, they're not necessarily killing the plant, but they'll mm-hmm. feed on those, like, growing tips, mm-hmm. and then that tip dies and the plant will have to put out, like, new branches. And so they kind of work to control a plant by taxing it metabolically. Every time, you know, they kill a new little shoot, that plant has to compensate somehow. And given enough time, those plants tend to suffer because they just can't keep up with the amount of damage the insects are causing.
Okay.
And then root feeders. Again, similarly, they just, you know, feed on the resources that the plants are putting down in their roots, impact their ability to, like, devote resources to producing seeds, and can eventually kill the plants if you give them enough time.
That's what's going to ask. So eventually it will kill the plants.
Most of them.
But, okay.
Well, it really depends on the system. Like every target weed or kind of responds a little differently.
Okay. So if you're just tuning in, I am speaking with Ian Knight. He is with the Aquatic Ecology and Invasive Species Branch, and he's an entomologist. Did I say that right that time?
Entomologist.
Okay. I have a problem saying that for some reason.
It's all good.
Okay. So what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of using bugs compared to other methods to manage these invasive plants?
All right. Yeah. So we'll start with the disadvantages. So probably one of the most obvious ones is developing biocontrol agents can take a really long time, up to and probably around 10 years to discover and approve a biocontrol agent for a particular weed. And then even after they've been evaluated and approved for release, getting them established can be really challenging. You know, they're organisms, they can be finicky. So like I said, they are living organisms, and, you know, how effective they can be can sometimes be can be influenced by climate or weather and just, you know, other biotic or abiotic factors. You know, for the insects that we work with, there are other insects out in these systems that will eat them. You know, I've released beetles just to see them kind of fly, and then a dragonfly come and scoop them up. So
you've seen that.
There's other things that eat them. So the trick is, you know, you got to get enough of them out, and you got to make sure they get established. The conditions have to be right.
Right.
And depending on the weed, these insects, like, are dependent on these plants for survival, so they generally won't eradicate an infestation. And by the time that you're using biocontrol as a tool, eradication is really no longer the end goal. Mm-hmm. The point for biocontrol is to try to reduce these weeds in the environment so much so that they're still present, but they're no longer causing the, you know, negative impacts that make them invasive species.
Right, right.
So yeah, now for the advantages. So the upsides to biocontrol are when you get establishment, they can provide perennial control with little to no, further input.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes you have to go back and maybe do some re-releases. But for the most part, once they get established, you know, your management costs go way down in the places where they're effective. They're host specific, which is one of the things that's really nice. So part of those, like that 10 or so years of development I was telling you about, a lot of that's spent making sure that they're not going to eat anything they're not supposed to.
I was thinking about that earlier. Like,
yeah.
How do you make sure of that?
Yeah. So the way that's done is, and I'm probably not the best person to ask, because
okay.
we don't do that kind of evaluation.
Okay.
Here at the core.
Okay.
Now there are agencies within the U.S. that'll do that, and there's lots of international collaborators that will help us do that kind of work.
Right.
And so I specifically don't do it. And among people who do biocontrol, I'm probably not the best, most qualified to answer it. But generally speaking, one of the things that happens, so when you start with a target weed, right? We've got mm-hmm. a weed that we're like, we want to see if we can find a biocontrol agent for this. The first step is, you know, we'll, you know, find a partner in the native range for mm-hmm. that weed, or native ranges, because sometimes these weeds can be really broadly distributed.
Mm-hmm.
First thing that'll happen is, like, after we've identified the weed, we identify our collaborators, is we will do some foreign exploration. So mm-hmm. that's it, go into these sites where these weeds are found,
mm-hmm.
Looking for all the things that eat it and infect it, and looking for all those natural enemies. Once we've found those natural enemies, the next big part, the part that takes like a really long time, is all that host range testing. And so what happens is when we find these new candidate agents,
mm-hmm.
We will develop what's called like a test plant list. And that is a list of all the plants that we can think of that these agents might potentially get onto. So usually it's plants that are like closely related to the target weed that are native to the U.S. And then there's like a series of experiments that are done to essentially make sure, all right, well, will this, you know, in the case of insects, will this insect eat any other plants or any of the plants that are on our list?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes they do, which isn't the end of the world.
Like, get off that.
Right. Sometimes they'll eat things that they're not, quote unquote, supposed to.
Right, right.
But that's still not the end of the world, because sometimes, like, you start off, you don't give them a choice. You just say, you take your bug, you take your plant, you put them together. And sometimes these insects are so host specific that they don't even recognize, you know, other plants as food. Sometimes they're so specific that even if they try to eat it, they just can't get what they need nutritionally out of it, and then they just starve anyway. Sometimes they will feed on it. Like, a lot of times, if you start starving your insects, they'll start eating whatever they can.
Right.
But again, a lot of times these plants aren't, you know, what these insects are evolved to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, they can feed on it a little bit. So you'll see them eating, but they don't really do a lot of damage, or they can't survive, or they won't reproduce. And so sometimes, even then, they may still reproduce on these plants. That's usually not a good sign. But a lot of times, what winds up happening is, you know, like, yeah, they may target other organisms, but, like, they have their preference. And it's really just when they don't, you know, when there's nothing else for them, they'll kind of get onto stuff they're not supposed to. And the further down you get down that list, the less likely they are
okay.
to be a suitable candidate. But regulatory agencies tend to be super gun shy. So if there's any hint that these guys might get onto something they're not supposed to, they usually won't pull the trigger.
Okay. Good to know. So, how do you select and test the suitability and safety of bugs for a specific invasive plant target? And we just kind of got into that.
I
skipped into that, didn't I? So is there anything else to add to what we were talking about?
Yeah, well, so just in terms of, like, advantages, like I said, one of the things that's really nice about biocontrol agents is because they're so host-specific, they tend to be, like, a much more flexible tool than something like herbicides. So that's, like, the major counterpoint. There's lots of different ways to manage weeds.
Mm-hmm.
what we focus on here at the core are, you know, our biocontrol team and then the herbicide team. Herbicides tend to be a much heavier hammer. Usually when you're using herbicides, you see results almost immediately, and those results tend to be a lot more impactful than what you might expect to see from biocontrol. Biocontrol can take a long time. You know, you got to get them established. And then even then, you know, they're not just going to come in. Sometimes they will. Sometimes you, like, you can release insects, and in a matter of months, they'll completely decimate a weed population. That's like the really nice examples. But most of the time, it can take a while. But they're only eating the things that they're supposed to. Herbicides tend to hammer everything they hit.
Right.
And so they're both management tools. I'm not like, this isn't saying like, oh yeah, man, everyone should just do biocontrol. the idea is that, you know, we have all these different management tools and they're different suited for different purposes. And so that's the nice thing about biocontrol is that they tend to kind of be a little bit more flexible.
Okay. Okay. I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
Everyone who places a sports bet with their Penn Play card at the end zone at Ameristar will receive an entry in a drawing for a pair of tickets to the Egg Bowl in Starkville on November 23rd. Qualifying bets can be placed from Tuesday, October 10th through Friday, November 10th. Drawing will be held on Saturday, November 11th. You don't have to be present to win. The winner will be notified by email and posted at the end zone sportsbook at Ameristar. Gambling problem? Call 1-888-777-9696.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Ian Knight. He is with the Environmental Laboratory, and we're talking about the good, the bad, and the bugly bugs and invasive plants. So, what are some of the challenges or risk involved in using bugs to control invasive plant species?
Yeah, so like I had said, the biggest challenge is probably establishment. Even effective agents can take a while to figure out how to get them established in the field, or it can take time to build up to numbers that are, you know, sufficient to provide adequate control. And even then, there's like biotic factors and abiotic factors that can cause confounding issues. So that's actually a big chunk of what I have been doing. Is I'm not working with brand new agents, although recently I've started to, but the bulk of my time at ERDC up to this point has actually been working with a couple of biocontrol agents called the alligator weed flea beetle and the alligator weed thrips. And these are not new biocontrol agents. These guys were released into the U.S. in like the late 60s, early 70s. And they did a great job. Right when they were released, they were fantastic. They were one of those silver bullet, you know, biocontrol agents. So much so that, you know, in the academic literature, no one was really publishing anything about alligator weed for probably about 30 to 40 years.
Okay.
Now it's also invasive in China. And so there's a big bulk of literature on alligator weed out of China, because they were, you know, they had that problem there, but we really weren't having an issue. But we are now. And the reason for that is, so when alligator weed first arrived, it was primarily along the Gulf Coast, which is kind of like that subtropical region. And so when the foreign exploration for these alligator weed flea beetles and other alligator weed biocontrol agents was done, they were looking in areas that were very climatically similar to the, you know, the Gulf Coast. And so we found these agents, we released them, they do a really good job. But what's wound up happening is alligator weed can grow in places that are more temperate than the Gulf Coast. And so we've been getting infestations that have been creeping northward into like Missouri, Tennessee, Arkansas, the Carolinas. And the problem with that is these insects that we've collected are kind of subtropical, tropical in origin. And what winds up happening is, you know, you can release them over the summer. Maybe you get control. Sometimes you don't. But, you know, over the winter, it just gets way too cold. And these guys just can't stick around. And so a big chunk of what we've been doing is looking at, you know, measuring the physiological cold tolerance of these insects to try to figure out how can we improve biological control in these places where it's now failing. Right. So it's not that these insects don't do a good job. It's that they're now in regions where we can't really get them established effectively.
And that brings up something that was in my head as we were talking, is that the seasons have got to affect the bugs. I mean,
They do. They absolutely do. So winter's the obvious one. You know, insects don't generally love it when it's cold. Right. Tropical ones even more so. And, you know, a lot of the insects that we have, you know, that are native up here, they have adaptations. You know, they go dormant in the winter. They usually have a particular life stage where, you know, they'll just overwinter as eggs or larvae or pupae. Like, they'll just hunker down and do nothing.
Right.
For a few months until it warms back up. These tropical insects have never had a reason to develop those adaptations or behaviors. And so when it gets too cold, all they really got is just their baseline cold tolerance. If they can't cut it, then they just die. But one of the other things that has been proving a really big challenge is it's not just the cold winters. As it turns out, for a lot of the places we're releasing in the temperate United States, not only are the winters much harsher, but the summers are much harder too. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we really get these just narrow windows in the spring. So if you release, they can do a really good job. They'll get out there, they'll eat a bunch of alligator weed, and then it gets too hot in the summer. And
they're like, I'm done.
Yeah. And we've had some projects where we're doing some releases at these northern sites, and it just gets so hot that the biocontrol agents can't cut it. And so we come back in the fall, which would be another great time for these agents to be out there eating, and they can't make it over the summer. So it's not even overwintering. It's like there's just really narrow windows where we get good biocontrol.
Wow. So, and again, we go into how do you measure success and effectiveness of this approach?
Yeah, so you kind of touched on something that I think is like a big point of contention among a lot of biocontrol folks, and that is a lot of post-release evaluation for a long time hasn't really been done. Mm-hmm. For a lot of weeds. And I think largely because you spend a lot of time getting everything spun up, you know, working to get things released. And then once you've kind of met that deliverable, no one really wants to just keep going back. I mean, the people who do biocontrol do, but everything costs money. And a lot of times, you know, it's move on to the next problem rather than sit and watch what happens with an old one for another 2 to 3 years.
Right.
And so there is a pretty big push among biocontrol scientists to really try to work that into projects where it's like, we're not just releasing them. We really need to release them and then like monitor to see, you know, what kind of control we're getting. And control looks different for different systems, right? You know, how, you know, defoliators might, you know, reduce a floating weed population within a single year. But, you know, one thing that we haven't really talked about are, you know, like for invasive arthropods, invasive insects, because mm-hmm. plants and insects tend to be the big ones.
Right.
When it comes to invasive species. And we have biocontrol agents for invasive insects. Like, those are actually kind of my babies. I don't get to work with them a lot here at the core, but I love parasitoid wasps. They're very cool.
Okay.
And so sometimes, like, these are pests of, you know, there's a biocontrol agent for emerald ash borer. And, you know, how you measure successful control of emerald ash borer looks very different than how you would measure control of giant salvinia.
Right,
you know, because those infestations look different. So how you measure success kind of depends on the system. But yeah, generally, the idea is, are you mitigating? I guess there's kind of two benchmarks, right? You want to look at, are these invasives still present in the system? And if mm-hmm. so, like, you know, at what levels? And I think more importantly, are your management objectives being met? Are your natives coming back? You know, are your dams and locks getting clogged up, you know, can boats get through your waterways?
Right.
And so I think that's another measure of success, but a lot of times it doesn't necessarily get related directly back to biocontrol. Oftentimes, because a lot of times in these systems, we're not just using biocontrol. Mm-hmm. You know, again, there's lots of different management tools, and biocontrol is kind of one of those ones that gets thrown in into a bunch of different ones.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna throw something out there to you. I mean, you're very passionate about your subject matter. When you were younger, did you imagine this is what you'd come to be doing?
No, it's really funny. So a lot of, especially, you know, in entomology, I think a lot of folks are like, oh man, did you just love bugs growing up? No, I hated bugs. I was like, terrified.
They were icky.
Terrified of most of them. I mean, or ambivalent. It wasn't like they were gross. It was just, I'd really rather, you know, I was just scared of them. You know, like you're scared of bees.
Right.
And when you don't know a lot about bugs, every bug is a bee. You know,
right.
And I was more interested in sustainability. That was something, especially, you know, I did my, one thing I didn't mention was I did my undergraduate in environmental science. So conservation, sustainability has always been something that I found really interesting. And then I just kind of lucked into my graduate degree program because like the way it was kind of advertised was as an IPM position, so integrated pest management. So that was, you know, which can include biological control, but it doesn't necessarily have to. So my background wasn't even originally in biocontrol, but that's how I got into entomology. And then I've slowly been shifting my career over to biocontrol, which I think is, you know, really what I want to do. So I'm pretty stoked to be here at ERDC because I'm kind of doing my dream job. It's really cool.
Well, everybody that sits in the seat that you are in now are always, they're passionate about what they do. And I was just, like I said, I was just picking up to see if this is what you envisioned yourself
it,
to
it is
be
not.
Doing.
If you had told me I was going to be an entomologist when I was five, I'd be like, what's an entomologist?
Speaking of that, I'm speaking with Ian Knight. We are talking about the good, the bad, and the bugly, bugs and invasive plant. He is an entomologist. Did I say it right that time?
Entomologist, yeah.
Yeah, I did it. Yay. Okay. He is with the Aquatic Ecology and Invasive Species branch. So this year, we're celebrating how the labs came together 25 years ago to form the One ERDC, one organization of experts across multiple disciplines. How do you communicate and collaborate with other researchers, stakeholders, or the public about your work on bugs and invasive plant management?
So, you know, even though we're not technically academia, I think, you know, a lot of the work that we do kind of mirrors how dissemination of information is done in academia. So more generally, like our work is communicated to other researchers and stakeholders via academic publications and technical notes and conference presentations. So, you know, we're constantly interfacing. Like one of the things about biocontrol in particular is it's a very collaborative discipline. And so, yeah, we're constantly reaching out to other biocontrol scientists around the world, you know, comparing notes, talking about, you know, new invasive species, better ways to get a lot of these agents established. Because it's not just, you know, so we don't just have invasive species here in the States. We've got invasive species are a problem all over.
Right.
So it's not just, you know, we're not just going to other countries to bring biocontrol agents here mm-hmm. to control our weeds. You know, South Africa has a huge biocontrol program, like lots of great biocontrol scientists in South Africa because they've got a lot of invasive aquatic weeds. They have a lot of the same invasive aquatic weeds that we have here. So things like water hyacinth, giant salvinia, water lettuce. So a lot of these invasive aquatic weeds, they have problems and they use a lot of the same agents that we do. And so, you know, when we have trouble getting these agents established, we might reach out to the South Africans and be like, hey, you know, this is a problem that we're having. And they'll be like, oh, well, you know, we've been trying it this way, or this is something that we've observed in our system. So there's a lot of it is kind of like, you know, behind the scenes,
right.
You know, because just it's not a huge community. And it's because it's such a collaborative one. There's lots of, you know, lots of emails. but I think more broadly, you know, publications, tech notes. Conference proceedings. Within ERDC, we do have the ARDI conference. It's been a couple of years since I presented at one, so I'm probably a little overdue.
Mm-hmm.
And then to the public, now I might be a little biased, but in my experience, like biocontrol is pretty cool. And there tends to be a lot of public interest. You know, it's one of those things where when you tell people that that's what you do, they everyone really wants to know more because it's just neat. I think it's one of those things where it's like, you know, herbicides are definitely a very powerful management tool.
Mm-hmm.
They can hit a problem very, very hard and usually make it go away really fast. Biocontrol does not work that effectively, but it is a little bit more romantic.
Mm-hmm.
And I like
the way you put that, romantic.
Yeah.
It gets people's attention too, like you said, because people, they like to learn more about how that can be effectively used.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I've been really lucky because folks will reach out to me.
Right.
Because, you know, they hear what I do and they're like, oh man, we want to hear more about that. So,
right.
So
right.
Yeah, in terms of just reaching out to the public, I've given multiple Master Gardener or Master Naturalist seminars.
Right.
Just because, yeah, people want to know about it.
I bet little kids do too.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that. Someone mentioned, you know, me giving a presentation to children. And like, I don't know, I think I tend to be a little bit too technical and verbose for putting me in front of children to necessarily be a good idea.
I'm understanding. Understanding what you're talking about. So what are some of the current or future projects or innovations that you are working on or involved in related to bugs and invasive plant management?
Yeah. So Some of the new ones that I'm really excited about is we're working on building a project to do some foreign exploration for an invasive species called European frog spit.
Okay.
I'm actually saying it wrong. It's European frog bit, not frog spit. and so it's a floating aquatic invasive up in the Great Lakes region. So okay. Kind of New York through over to Wisconsin. Does all the same things that I described earlier with clogging up waterways, displacing native vegetation. Kind of integrated into that project, we are hoping to do some work with Water Soldier. So we don't actually have Water Soldier here in the States yet, but Water Soldier and European frog spit tend to co-occur. We're in Europe, and so we're kind of hoping that we're going to do this foreign exploration for European frog spit, but also keep an eye out for some potential Water Soldier biocontrol agents, because it's one of those species that's kind of like on the horizon. Mm-hmm. And so it'd be really good to try to nip that in the bud. So that's going to be really exciting. It's the first time I've been directly involved in a foreign exploration project, so I'm really excited about that. Another project I'm pretty stoked about is we are spinning up a giant Sylvania IPM project. And so I mentioned IPM earlier, and what that stands for is integrated pest management. And the idea is that it's how do we effectively integrate different management tools?
Okay.
Now, in the case of this study, what we're doing is we're looking at how we can effectively integrate herbicide management and biocontrol agents. Because we have herbicides that can hit Sylvania really hard, that tends to be really effective. And we got biocontrol agents that are also very, very effective. And traditionally, what's been the case in giant Sylvania management is you usually do one or the other. The upside to the weevils is when you get them established, they tend to just kind of get rid of Sylvania as a problem. It's still mm-hmm. present, but they can provide really good control, but they can take a really long time to get established, and they're not very cold tolerant. And so when you see these really bad infestations, usually kind of like, Eastern Texas, Northern Louisiana, I think we might have some in Mississippi. They've got a big problem up in South Carolina. So in these places where the winters get quite a bit colder, we can't really use the weevils effectively because it takes them too long to get established, and they just don't survive the winter well enough to provide adequate control. Herbicides are really powerful, but in a lot of these systems, because it's a floating aquatic weed, and not only is it a floating aquatic, but it's the plants are also quite small. Mm-hmm. Individually they're quite small. They form these giant mats, but and so that means they can kind of worm their way in through places that are otherwise really inaccessible. Mm-hmm. So if you think about a lot of these waterways, they're just full of cypress. There's lots of little inlets, lots of other vegetation. And Sylvania can get right up underneath all of that. And so getting adequate coverage with your herbicides is really, really difficult.
Right.
The weevils don't have a problem. They can get into all those little nooks and crannies, but we have trouble getting them established. Herbicides are more powerful, but we can't necessarily hit them where we need to. And so what this project is aiming to do is look at how we can integrate herbicide and biological control to improve management.
Okay.
And so IPM is a big thing in agriculture. It's not something you see done in control of environmental weeds. Mm-hmm. A big reason for that is because of how integrated pest management is evaluated. You really need a benchmark by which to evaluate your success. And we don't really have those for environmental weeds. So if we were growing cotton, so I worked in cotton for my master's, mm-hmm. if we were growing cotton, part of integrated pest management is having what we call like economic injury levels and action thresholds. And what those are is it's essentially how much damage is a particular pest going to cause versus how much is it going to cost us to treat it.
Right.
And so what you want to do is figure out how much of a particular pest you're willing to tolerate, or not willing, but can you tolerate before it is less expensive for you so that you don't lose as much money as you would wind up paying for a particular pesticide. Or break even, or ultimately right. You don't really want to break even. You really want to like have higher yield. The problem is if you treat a pest when populations are really, really low, you don't know that you're necessarily preventing a significant amount of damage. You're just spending money on herbicides. Mm-hmm. And if you wait too long, it doesn't really matter. You know, you've already lost a significant portion of your yields, you know, to damage. And then you're just, and then you might recover some of it by using pesticides to kind of knock your pests back. But it, so it's finding where that economic level is to, you know, maximize profits. Because that's the ultimate thing, right? It's like, it's money. It's how much money are you making? How much money are you spending? Mm-hmm. And in environmental systems, we don't have those thresholds. I mean, really, we would prefer that these weeds just not be there at all. But part of what we're doing in this project is we've got this kind of management strategy that we call maintenance control. And maintenance control wasn't originally developed as an IPM strategy. One of the things when I became a part of this project, I looked at, you know, the protocol for maintenance control, and I was like, this provides a really good framework for conducting integrated pest management in an environmental weed system. And so we're using maintenance control strategy, like a maintenance control strategy, to evaluate how to integrate herbicides and weevils. So I don't know. I think I just rambled on about something very technical, but it's a project I'm very excited about. It's going to be very cool. Another one that I'm pretty stoked about is developing a physiology-based climate model. Mm-hmm. So when you have invasive species or you have biocontrol agents, one of the questions you want to ask yourself is, where are these agents going to establish? Mm-hmm. You know, climatically, you know, when we kind of know this, you can kind of intuit it. It makes a little bit of common sense, right? So if you go to South America and you go collect a tropical insect, you know that insect's probably only going to do well, you know, like, you know, along the Gulf Coast, you know, in our subtropical climates down in Florida, down in Texas. And because it's intuitive, but there's other climatic variables that go into that. And the way, and there's a more sophisticated way of modeling it. But the way that that's been typically been done is you look at where a species occurs in its native range, and you look at the climate of those areas, and you kind of superimpose that over the, you know, the target range, and you say, like, all right, well, these areas are climatically similar to places where this insect is found, or this, you know, biocontrol agent is found, or weed. You can do climate matching for anything. Mm-hmm. And so we think that based on these similarity in climates, that, you know, this species will do well in this particular place, or these places are very different, so we don't think that they're going to do very well. But it's just a presence-absence-based thing. It's like, if we see them in one place, we just kind of make the assumption that they'll do well somewhere else. And what this model is trying to do is it looks at physiological measurements that we've, you know, determined experimentally. So we're actually measuring cold tolerance, and then we take those values and we plug them into a model. So it's not just, do we see them here? Do we see them there? Will we see them there? It's like, this is how hot it can get for this long before our insects are going to die. Or this is how cold it can get for this long before these insects are going to die. And so I spent a lot of time, mostly last year, developing this model. And so we need to collect a little bit more data before we're ready to publish any of it. And there's definitely some kinks that need some working out, but it's a very cool model that I'm very excited about. So,
well, as listeners always find out, it's always about the data, mm-hmm. data. And that's what ERDC, you know, collects and to analyze these things. So that's so very important for what you do. So what are some of the resources or opportunities that are available for people who want to learn more about bugs and invasive plant management?
So the best resources are going to be like state agricultural extension. I can't speak to every state, but you know, I'm pretty sure that most state land grant universities have some kind of agricultural extension. Some have really big programs. So the ones that come to mind are the places that I've been. Mm-hmm. So UGA has huge agricultural extension. University of Florida, I think Mississippi does too. Mm-hmm. But I just haven't been as involved. So I don't know what resources are available through Mississippi. But yeah, the best thing to do is find your local extension agent and field questions. That's kind of their job.
Right, exactly.
There's also several universities put out kind of profiles on invasive species and biological control agents. So again, two that come to mind are University of Florida. They've got tons of invasive species in Florida. They do lots of biocontrol. And UF puts out these little kind of species profiles for a lot of their invasive weeds, for and the biocontrol agents that feed on them. So if you're looking for information, those profiles, a lot of good information. LSU does something very similar. They'll put out these like species profiles for invasive species and biocontrol agents.
Okay.
Another one that comes to mind, again, because I was at UGA, and I know some of the folks who run it, the Bugwood Center for Invasive Species and Ecosystem Health, that's run out of UGA. And again, another really good resource for learning about invasive species and biocontrol.
Okay.
I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
Visit Wells and Lahat to shop Whirlpool washers that help you keep up with the laundry. A top-load Whirlpool washer with a smooth impeller gives clothes a thorough yet gentle cleaning. And the deep water wash option adds more water when you need it for heavily soiled loads. Elevate your laundry game with a Whirlpool washer. Stop in and pick the exact one you want at Wells and Lahat, located next to Goldie's Trail on the South Frontage Road.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
Well, we're fixing to wrap up here. I have been speaking with Ian Knight. He's an entomologist.
Yeah, just not etymologist, because that's something different.
Entomologist. And he is with the Environmental Laboratory. He's with the Aquatic Ecology and Invasive Species branch of the Environmental Laboratory. And we were talking about the good, the bad, and the bugly, bugs and invasive plants. So what would you like listeners to learn from this valuable conversation?
So I think the big one, and it seems a little obvious, but be cognizant that invasive species exist. Follow the rules when recreating. These rules exist for a reason. So when you see signs that say wash your boats, because that's how a lot of these aquatic invasive species spread. And, you know, when these species get into systems, they'll start to displace native species. So if you like to fish, these are like just more weeds that you're going to have to fish around. Mm-hmm. Increased management costs. It's just one more thing for managers to have to spend their time spraying and monitoring and dealing with. So from an aquatic weed standpoint, another one, like don't move firewood. Same reason. These rules exist because we don't want people moving things around. And a lot of times these insects are really, really good at capitalizing on human behavior to spread.
Really?
So yeah, like, be aware that invasive species exist. Follow the rules. Don't move stuff around. A lot of invasive species can be really pretty, and when they're not being obnoxious, they're really cool to look at. So mm-hmm. things like water hyacinth is a beautiful plant, and like weed scientists die a little inside whenever they see a Facebook post of someone's like, "Oh, I found this really plant." I'm like, and I moved it from my pond or from this one pond to another. Because people just see like, oh, this is something pretty, and like, I want this to be in more places. And it's like, no,
you didn't.
a really, really good example is, so you know starlings, mm-hmm. horribly invasive birds. Do you know how starlings got to the United States?
Please tell me.
They were introduced intentionally, and the guy who introduced them did so because he thought that that North America needed all the birds that were mentioned in Shakespeare's plays.
Okay. Somebody's calling you about that. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. So like silly stuff. And, you know, and especially before people really had the wherewithal to be paying attention to invasive species, things like kudzu, you know.
Right.
Nowadays, things are not brought in without, you know, a significant amount of vetting. But things like kudzu, they were released because, you know, they thought it would provide erosion control.
Not so much.
Yeah, horribly invasive. I'm drawing a blank on some other like invasive species that were...
That are well known.
Yeah, or that were brought over intentionally, and right. then they just cause other problems. Like frog's bit, I think, escaped from a botanical garden. So it's we really want to be careful. And certainly, if you're ever traveling abroad, don't bring stuff back.
Right.
It's illegal, and it's a really, really bad idea.
Okay. Okay. Hear that, everyone? Don't bring it back.
be aware that invasive species exist, and just try not to... one of the reasons it spreads.
Think of kudzu, everyone. So, Ian, thank you so much for being here today. It's been very, very educational, and hope you come back again sometime.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, everyone, have a wonderful day, and we'll come back at you next week.